Felt Museum.
Hey everyone, it's Tom Candela from Curtain Call. This week on the show, I'm taking you inside one of the most influential organizations in American theater. It's New Dramatists. Join me for a fascinating conversation with artistic director Emily Morse, playwright and Broadway librettist Christopher Diaz, and Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Susan Laurie Parks as we explore mentorship and the creative process behind some of today's most celebrated theater. That's this week on Curtain Call, Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, David Saloy, author of the novel Flesh. Saloy says he wanted to write a character whose experience of the world is entirely physical, not psychological. The book's been praised as a stark and revealing portrait of masculinity. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Okay, good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character on Radio Catskill. There's lots of traffic here today. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg, and I'm also with, I am so happy, the fabulous Rosie Starr, who is helping me by performing her audio and recording skills. Hey, Rosie.
Good morning, Donna. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's a gorgeous day in Milford.
This is the best day of the week. I heard it on the radio coming down. And where we are is Milford, Pennsylvania, at the Columns Museum of the Pike County Historical Society, about to speak with the director, Laurie Strzelecki. We're going to speak to her about the museum and the significance of the museum and the surrounding area as we celebrate all throughout this year of the 250th anniversary of America's signing of the Declaration of Independence. Let's go inside.
Okay, Donna, let's go.
Gorgeous.
Yes, it's an impressive building. Look at the woodwork on these doors. It's really beautiful.
And the stained glass.
So much to find out.
Hi. Hi.
Welcome to the Columns. How are you today?
We're good. This is good. Laurie Strzelecki,
yes,
am I pronouncing
right.
That right? The director of the museum. And I want to thank you so much for having us here today. I really appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Let's start by getting acquainted with you. You are a Jersey girl. So am I.
Proudly. I was born and raised in Passaic, New Jersey, and had a great time growing up there. I went to a Polish Catholic school, and that was grammar school, and then I went to Passaic High School, and I left New Jersey to move to Delaware with my family in the early 80s, I guess. Didn't stay there long, but I lived there long enough to get a few years of college in. I couldn't decide what I wanted to do for a living or with my life, so I changed majors many, many times at Delaware Technical Community College. I went from criminal justice to graphic design to communications to food service, anything, and I just got a very well-rounded look at all the opportunities and jobs that were out there and worked at many of them until I was about 30 and my interest in history peaked and voila.
Had a lot of interests and you pursued them, and I think that's great. The first thing I want to talk about is Waterloo Village, because I know you did work there. I was wondering if you know what's going on now down there. It's hard to fund places like that, isn't it, Laurie?
I would agree. In my time at Waterloo Village, it was good times and bad times even back then. They were always fortunate enough to have a very well-adjusted board of directors that was willing to contribute in the early days. And then I think as that changed and people moved on or died or whatever the circumstances were, and I think the funding changed. And if I'm not mistaken, it was taken over now by one of the state parks or the park system of New Jersey, which is fine. I think the park system does a good job, but I'm not really sure how savable Waterloo Village is. You know, it's an in-situ canal town. The buildings are old and they needed work back then, and you neglect them long enough, they get worse, not better. I'm very happy to say that I know the Canal Society still exists there and they do a lot of good work. So hopefully one day they'll figure it all out and it could be revived to the great place that we both know it could be and was.
You know, speaking of the fact that we both know it, I forgot that maybe the listeners don't know what Waterloo Village is. So maybe you could just tell the listener what it is.
The town of Waterloo exists as an in-situ canal town that once was a bustling stop on the Morris Canal. The Musconetcong River feeds it and leads all the way up to Lake Opakong at its height and then goes all the way to Newark, follows quite a path. I mean, I think it's Phillipsburg to Jersey City is the path that the Morris Canal took.
Interesting, because we're right here near Honesdale, and the canals also...
The Delaware and Hudson Canal, of course, is a... All canals are a marvel, just the way they figured out how to get the boats up and down and the lock systems and building them. You know, so the Delaware and Hudson Canal has an anniversary coming up. I love the Delaware and Hudson Canal and the history there. I mean, as much as I love the Morris Canal, they're different, but they both have their grand styles of their own. I mean, to transport coal from the mountains here to get it to the markets in Philadelphia and New York. So they found a way to get it from Honesdale to Kingston, and then down the Hudson to other ports. So an amazing, amazing marvel of building and industry. I mean, and, you know, everything was transported along the canals. So it wasn't just coal. I mean, people and things. We have a piano here in the museum that was actually brought here via the canal and then brought here by buckboard. I don't know where we'd be without canals and without coal, for that matter.
Okay, so Lori, we're celebrating our 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And, you know, we associate those times with Boston, you know, the Boston Tea Party, Philadelphia, where the signing took place, New York. So people may wonder, why should we include the Columns Museum here in Milford? And what would you say to them?
There really was not much going on here in Pike County in 1776, but the Columns Museum has decided that we would show you how far that the United States came in that 100 years between 1776 and 1876. And we have several items on display and original items from what was called the Philadelphia Centennial, which took place in Philadelphia in 1876 and was really the first World's Fair. They wanted to show how far we've come in 100 years, so Heinz ketchup. Ketchup was invented, popcorn, bananas were there. There was participation from all kinds of foreign countries, and it was just a World's Fair. Everybody was there. So let's see what else. The telephone was the first time the telephone was used was there. So there was a telephone in one of the halls, and you could call the next hall over and talk on the telephone. Oh, Tufts invented Arctic soda, so the soda fountain was introduced there. And then when everybody came back from the Philadelphia Fair, they went to their local druggist and was like, you got to get this soda fountain stuff. This is the best thing, you know. It's all different flavors. And so there's a lot of things that were introduced. The Corliss engine, a tabletop butter churn. And then there were interesting people there as well. There was the butter lady, a lady who did sculpture totally in butter. So she was the highlight of the centennial exhibition. So it was just an interesting thing, and it was a great success. Gillander Glass, now located in Port Jervis, took a big gamble and built a factory on the fairgrounds. And they produce souvenirs, and we have several of them on display because Gillander still had the molds from a lot of the things. So any of the money that any of the vendors made there, they had to give a big portion of it back to the fair itself, but they all pretty much came away making out okay anyway.
What exactly is the role of a history museum like this? It's not just about the preservation of artifacts.
No. Well, first of all, we have three goals here. One is to keep this house in good shape because it's a 1904 neoclassical mansion. I mean, the place is a money pit. So, you know, obviously that's our biggest concern, is keeping the house in good shape. We've had a lot of work done on it in my time here. I've been here 26 years. I've seen it come from, you know, rotting columns on the front to what they look like now, and leaking roofs and chimneys and everything that you could imagine we've had to deal with here. And then we're a museum, so we have to keep all our artifacts in the best condition we possibly can, you know, without a leaky roof, and put up new exhibits and teach people about Pike County's history as well as national history, because we do have a few things that might be considered very important to history itself, like the Lincoln flag. And then also to run a historical society. And we have archives and records that we maintain here, and a genealogy library. So we really have a threefold mission here. And it's getting harder and harder, honestly, to fund all three. So you got to pick one. And mostly we pick the building, because without the building, it doesn't matter what we have.
This is probably a good time for me to ask you, how can people of Pike County or Wayne County or anyone living in this area support this museum? Are there memberships to the museum? Why don't we hear about that?
Well, yeah, because we're a museum. We're open 5 days a week for the summer. And so obviously you could come and visit. and, you know, give us your admission fee. And you get a pretty good tour. You get to see two floors of exhibits, I think 11 rooms. Also, you could be a member. So we have memberships that range from $25 all the way up to as much as you feel like giving us. $500 is the level that's named, but if you want to give us more, please do. And we'll come up with a name for that level. That's fine. You know, donations. We do fundraising. I write grants. I wear a lot of hats here. I've seen it all. I've tried it all. And we have a formula that works, so we stick with it. We do dinner and a movie, and we do music, and we do plays and lectures and historical programming. So you name it, we've probably done it. We just had a softball game on Sunday for the community.
What are you cooking at dinner and a movie?
Because I'm from Passaic and Wallington, we've done Polish night once a year here, and that's always very well received. I've done Italian. They like my spaghetti and meatballs. We call it Polish spaghetti and meatballs because it's a little different, but it's delicious. And you name it, we've done it here. Wine and cheese. Sometimes I ask people, what do you want for dinner? And they'll tell me, and then I'll try and make it. So I don't mind cooking. I like cooking.
If you're not a member, how would you find out about dinner and a movie night, for example?
Well, we do dinner and a movie usually once a month, but we do stop for July and August because we're very busy with visitation. Oh, okay. So, but it's usually the second or third Wednesday of the month, and it's on our website, which is pikehistorical.org, or our Facebook page, The Columns Museum, or we have a newsletter if you're a member that you'll receive, but we put them out in the community as well. You know, social media is pretty much the best way to keep on track with what's going on here. And the movies that we do, in a nod to the science fiction history here in Milford. The Virginia Kid Agency is a science fiction publishing house that introduced the Milford method of critiquing science fiction many, many years ago, and it still exists. So we do a nod to science fiction and show the 1950s B-horror movies, and everybody joins in and makes fun of them. And, you know, we've shown everything from The Blob to, I think in September we have Gorgo scheduled, and that's a strange one that no one's ever heard of. And I do try and find the ones that nobody's seen yet, as well as the popular ones. And we've shown, I don't know, I'd say over 100 of those over the last 10 years. And we have a following for that. We have like the same group that comes all the time. And we get some new people here and there, and they have a great time. And it's just you have dinner, and then we watch the movie, and then we have homemade desserts, and everybody goes home laughing or having had a good time and a good meal.
That sounds fantastic. So let's move over to this exhibit. Tell us about this exhibit.
Well, this is the Gillander Glass 1876 Centennial Exhibition. This is what they sold at the exhibition in Philadelphia. One of the most popular items was this glass slipper. That was the number one selling souvenir at the World's Fair. This was something that everybody wanted. Then you had your commemorative butter dishes, glassware, busts of presidents, etc., plates. They recreated these on site. They created a big factory. The front part of the factory was their retail or shop, and then in the back you could go and watch how they made things. And most of these things were made from molds, and the molds were kept. So these were made out of the original molds that they had at the Centennial Exhibition in 1876.
So the Gillander glass was from Philadelphia.
They were from Philadelphia initially. So when they decided to take the gamble and open up the souvenir shop at the exhibition, years after that, they bought a factory in Port Jervis and moved their operation here. Now they are still in business, although they don't do this kind of thing anymore. They're like the leading maker of like airplane glass, like landing lights and things like that for the airplane industry.
We'll be right back with Lori Strzelecki, director of the Columns Museum in Milford, Pennsylvania, on Radio Catskill.
Reporter intimidation takes many forms, like the subpoenas served by the DOJ to New York Times reporters, or what happened to two bloggers writing about eBay.
Sending subpoenas to the reporter is to say what you're doing is not allowed.
It might as well be a pig fetus.
Or it might as well be a box of maggots.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's all about summertime hosting and guesting in delicious style. From brilliant, simple sides and desserts you can bring to your next party to a lifestyle expert's tips on hosting, that's all coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Thank you. On This Old House Radio Hour, we settle the debate, top load or front load, which washing machine reigns supreme.
There is one difference that front loaders can take advantage that top loaders cannot, and it's gravity.
Plus, author Mary H.K. Choi on the suburban Texas house that left a homesick teenager wondering if she'd landed in a horror movie. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character on Radio Catskill with today's guest, Lori Strzelecki, director of the Columns Museum in Milford, Pennsylvania. Here we go. I'd love for you to talk about the history of the house.
Dennis McLaughlin had this house built in 1904, and he was a businessman from Jersey City. His doctor told him, "Your life is so hectic, Dennis, you should build yourself a little house in the country." And this is what he came up with. It's 22 rooms and 11 bedrooms. He had four children living with him here and his second wife and a nanny. He didn't live here that long. He did die shortly after having the house built. And then it stayed in the family till about 1930. And then after that, it seemed to change hands on the average of every 7 years. It was a private residence, boarding house, a nightclub, a bar, a restaurant, a dance studio, a home for the VFW. I've worked here for 26 years, so I think I've probably spent the most time in this house than any of the owners.
Are there any ghosts in this house?
We've had several ghost investigations here. Sullivan Paranormal actually did a reveal of what they found, and they said there's five ghosts. There's two men, two women, and a little girl. Strangely, a Revolutionary War soldier is one of the ghosts that haunts the columns. That's our big connect to the Revolutionary War. I just figured it out.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, what role did Pike County residents play in America's history? So maybe there was a family here or people that lived here or were acquainted with the house. Somebody died on the Revolutionary War battlefield.
If I ever see him, I'll surely ask him. Please his ask association. Him.
Yes.
But other than that, what was going on here in 1776? Philadelphia. You know, there's lots going on there, obviously, but the closest we had to a battle or anything associated with the Revolutionary War was Minisink, Battle of Minisink. And then Joseph Brant did sack Port Jervis a day before that battle. So
tell the listener who Joseph Brant is.
Oh, he was a Mohawk leader that was in charge of the troops.
Of our troops?
No.
Yeah,
no.
That's why I just want to make sure the listener understands that was the British.
Yes. And so he had his Native American folks with him and, some other soldiers. And so they went up to battle and right across the river from what would be Pike County's Lackawaxen by the Roebling Bridge over there. And years after the Battle of Minisink, some people who were working on the canal, I believe, found a body in a cave or on a cliff or something. But they assumed that he was a revolutionary soldier because of the things that were found around him. Mm. And they didn't know who he was, but they did bury him in Lackawaxen. So you'll find the grave of the unknown soldier from the Revolutionary War in Lackawaxen, Pennsylvania.
You know, I just want to add about Joseph Brant, this Native man. It sounds bad, you know, oh yeah, the Indians wiped out a whole city. But we have to remember how the Native people were treated by the settlers, by our forefathers. They were promised the world and they got nothing. So there was a lot of pent-up frustration, and that's why a lot of them joined the British Army, correct?
Sure, because in 1737 was when, the Penn brothers perpetrated this fraud, I would say, on them. But they came up with a document that they claimed was valid, the walking purchase. Mm. And so that wasn't William Penn. William Penn's sons were the ones who were land hungry. William Penn had a good relationship or as best as it could be, with the Native Americans at that time. And so once he was kind of out of the picture, his son stepped in and came up with this walking purchase document, and it basically robbed the Indians out of three times the amount of land they were willing to give up.
Amazing. Well, we can't leave before we see the Lincoln flag.
Let's do it.
You know, when we turned around in the dining room there and we started walking to it, I got like a chill. It's either the ghosts or just the whole idea. Well, you tell the story, Lori.
Well, the Lincoln flag is a large 36-star flag. It's 153 inches by 104 inches, so you get an idea. It's not just your normal size flag. It's quite big. And this was used as bunting or decoration over the balustrade of the presidential box the night Lincoln was shot. So after he was shot, they laid him on the ground, and they were trying to wait until there was a time where they knew they could maybe somehow get him out of the theater, because the theater had kind of gone a little crazy once they realized what had happened. And they wanted to make him comfortable, so they just grabbed this flag that was draped over the balcony in front of them, bunched it up, and stuck it under his head. And what you see on the flag here are blood stains. So his head bled onto the flag, and then they took him across the street to the Peterson House, where, of course, he died the next morning, unfortunately. But the flag was left there in the presidential box, and one of the actors in the play, Thomas Gourlay, took it. And then several years later, he left it in the care of his daughter, Jeannie, who was also in the play. We actually have the bodice that she wore on. We have three of her costumes, because she ended up marrying and moving to Milford in 1888. Oh. And when she came here, she brought the flag. She brought three of her stage costumes. She lived here till she died in 1928, left it to her son, and he gave it to the museum, all these things, to the museum in 1954.
So this display, as we see it now, has been here since 1954?
Oh, no, this is not the original case from the Lincoln flag. The inner case is, and it used to stand in the corner, and it went to Ford's Theater for the 150th anniversary of the assassination. It was part of a blood relic exhibit with other artifacts with Lincoln's blood on them. They built out a beautiful exhibit, and this blue that you see on the outside was part of that. And then when the flag was coming back, it was there for 3 months. I said to the curator there, who had become pretty good friends, we'd spoken a lot on the phone, I said, well, what are you going to do with that blue outer case that it's in? She says, oh, it's out in the alley right now. We threw it out. So I talked her into going and getting it. It was in pieces. And then her and her mom actually drove it here on like Mother's Day or something and brought it to me. She was a nice lady. And a friend of mine put it together, and we put the flag in it. So we've had it. It was an upgrade. So we had it ever since.
Do you ever notice when people walk in here and they stand in front of the flag, do you ever notice anything? Like, does it get quiet?
Yeah. I've seen people break down in tears. Mm. It moves a lot of people. And I can understand why. Lincoln is still probably the most revered president. You know, there's still books being written about him. So there's always seems to be new things coming out about Lincoln. But yeah, so I've seen people, you know, get very emotional or just, you know, take, of course, and they want to take a picture. And I think it has a profound effect on a lot of people.
Absolutely. The Declaration of Independence stated American ideals, and 90 years later, Lincoln is assassinated. Lori, would you agree that the Lincoln flag reminds us that work begun in 1776 has yet to be finished?
I think there's always work to be done, right? We'll never actually finish, and nobody will always go along with the best ideals. There's always going to be some pushback. So you got to keep trying. You just can't give up. So you have to go with those good ideals and just stick to your guns and hope.
And that's the thing about being an American. If you don't agree with anything that's going on, you can talk about it. You have free speech. We got to make sure that newspapers keep publishing, museums keep going, people keep learning about history. It's the most important thing. And I think this year of the 250th anniversary, that's the time to really push that message home.
The radio is great, but we can't rely on social media. Social media is the downfall of our society. Of course, we use social media to promote the museum. You know, we use the newspapers as well. We hope and pray our press releases get in. You know, people save newspapers. Remember, you know, we had Life magazines, and this is where we got the national news, and this is where we learn things. Now, we don't know if what we're reading is true or not in most cases with AI and all this. I know people come in here to do research, genealogy research, and I could be showing them an original deed with their family's name on it, the original. And I go, well, that's wrong because I read on Ancestry.com. It was a different date. I'm like, but yeah, that's human error. It's entered by humans, the date. So maybe they made a mistake because I'm showing you the original and they still don't buy it because they didn't read it on their phone.
Lori, if you could choose one item in this museum that you think symbolizes the American story, what would it be?
Well, I want to give you a good answer to that. The Helene Curtis permanent wave machine.
Well, you know, I was a hairdresser for 10 years, so I love that answer. Okay. Please tell me why you chose that.
We've come a long way, baby, right? You know, women would go into the beauty parlor or salon and have these electric wires stuck on their heads. There's one upstairs if you want to take a picture, look at it. Thankfully, we don't do that anymore. So it symbolizes how far women have come in a silly way, but it's true.
I love it. That was a great answer.
Thanks.
So here's another question like that.
Okay.
If the walls of the Column Museum could speak, what might they say about America at the ripe old age of 250?
What took you so long to come and visit?
Yeah, we want to encourage everybody to come here. It's fantastic. I would love to sleep here.
Could be arranged. We've had Girl Scout sleepovers.
Ooh, Rosie.
I'm game.
We could have a sleepover, and we could see if we see any of those ghosts.
Yeah, we've had ghost, you know, investigations here. We do Girl Scout sleepovers, Boy Scout sleepovers. You know, I've stayed here a few times myself. I've never had any strange experiences, but what can I say? They don't mess with me.
Lori, when people leave the museum, especially during this year, the 250th anniversary, what do you hope they carry with them? Not just about the history, but also about being an American today.
Well, I hope they see or understand that museums, the future for museums might not be that bright if people don't start to acknowledge and appreciate what we do and what we have here. Yeah, you could learn about anything by looking it up, right? But if you want to actually see it and experience it in person, I think a museum is a great place to come. And I think kids should be brought to museums. And I think adults that have never been here should come here. And I think that this place in particular has something for everyone. From national history, we have an 1850 stagecoach, you know, that we just had in a parade. We have a little bit about all the people who made up Pike County, the great history of Pike County and how important they are. Deeds, documents. I don't know. I think everybody needs to immerse themselves in a little bit of history firsthand and just to look around. If it's not your thing, then you just leave. But also, we need your support. So just come in and see if there's something here for you. Give us a chance to win you over, and I'm sure there's something that you'll enjoy here, and you'll be like, maybe I should buy a membership, or how are they going to survive? Like I said, it's a three-pronged effort here. We have to maintain the building, we have to maintain our collections, and we have to maintain our archives and library. Not every historical society has the burden that we do. So I wish people would understand that and just, you know, open up their hearts and open up their wallets a little bit and give us a little help. This place isn't supported on, you know, we own the building. It's not a government entity. It's not, you know, funded by the National Park Service or the Forestry Service or whatever the case might be with other historical sites around here. We're on our own, you know, and so we're just the Pike County Historical Society who happens to, you know, have this great old building that we're trying to maintain, and then all the stuff inside of it that is important to our history. So you could find us at pikehistorical.org, or you could go to our Facebook page, The Columns Museum. That's it.
Thank you for having us here today.
Thanks.
I am so happy to have been here.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Tell all your friends.
I will.
Okay.
As we mark the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, a visit to the Columns Museum offers a chance to step back into the rich history of Pike County. My thanks to Lori Strzelecki for the wonderful tour and to Rosie Starr for joining me and recording our conversation today. Catskill Characters on every Saturday at 11:30. Please join me then for more conversations with fabulous characters of the Catskills here on Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life, when a beloved tree was mysteriously cut down in a national park in Britain, people across the country called it slaughter.
They said things like, "R.I.P. beautiful tree, I wish I'd got to meet you."
But the suspect could not care less. My understanding, he said, was that it was just a tree. The very serious and entirely ridiculous criminal trial over a murdered tree this week.
Tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill. On last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, our panelist Alonzo Bowden caught World Cup fever.
The Cup's been exciting. It's been great. It's amazing how many Africans are in Belgium.
I'm Tom Papa, filling in for Peter Sagal. Tune in to hear us kick around this week's news and talk to legendary rock guitarist Vicki Peterson on this week's Wait, Wait, the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we just ask the question.
Is that statement true?
Get to the point with NPR every weekday morning.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.